Please be seated. Good afternoon. Before I call the case, I would like to introduce to you all the Middleton High School mock trial team. Would the members of the team please stand? Well, good afternoon. You may be seated. And I gather that you're here because attorney Bruce Rosen is your team's coach and is arguing today. He's going to show you how to do it and maybe how not to do it. We'll see. That's a challenge, sir. Before, again, I call the argument, let me introduce the members of the court to you all. On my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. And to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, I'm going to call our last case for today and for the May calendar, 01-1589 CR State versus James R. Thiel. Attorney Bruce Rosen, who will argue for Mr. Thiel. Counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice. Also appearing on behalf of Dr. James Thiel is Susan Blester, my partner. I'd like to try and frame the four issues that I believe are before the court in the form of four questions. One, is it constitutionally adequate in a criminal trial for the defense lawyer not to read the discovery or the facts? Two, is it constitutionally adequate in the state of Wisconsin for a criminal defense lawyer before the trial not to read the facts or the law? Number three, is it constitutionally adequate in the state of Wisconsin for a criminal defense lawyer before the trial not to read the facts, the law, or do any independent investigation? And number four, what weight, if any, to give to the trial court who rendered, I believe, a most compelling 24-page opinion that basically dictated or suggested and ordered in the interest of justice, because the integrity of the system had been challenged, because the adversary system had broken down, in his judgment, ordered a new trial. Going back to the factual question, it was unchallenged at the Mockner hearing. And I'd never done a Mockner hearing. I mean, it's the most unseemly kind of hearing. Trial counsel indicated on cross-examination by myself that before the trial there were portions of the discovery that were not read.
Counsel, can I just ask a question before you get into this? One would assume, and having read the facts also, that after your client terminated his first two attorneys and hired the other individual, just so I'm on the right track here factually, that he, the defendant, your client, indicated that he wanted to go to trial right away because he had some considerations, which I won't go into. One was the other acts, evidence, things of that nature. Does that put any different, quote, spin on the facts, or does that make any difference as far as what the client wanted and what he told his attorney as far as going to trial and not asking for any adjournment or postponement or anything like that?
I don't think it makes any difference. At the Mockner hearing, I posed the hypothetical to trial counsel. Assume for the purpose of my question that trial counsel is unprepared to try the case, but the client is demanding or insisting that the case go forward. Mr. Brinkman, how would you resolve that dilemma? His answer was, I believe, well, Mr. Rosen, this is a very intelligent client, relatively sophisticated, highly educated. I would defer to his judgment. At which point, I believe the record indicates, I told Mr. Brinkman, I think that answer is unequivocally wrong under the law. I indicated to him that under your rules, Supreme Court Rule 21.2, there really are only three decisions that the client gets to overrule the lawyer on. One, whether to go to trial or plead guilty. Two, whether at that trial to have a jury. And three, whether at that trial to testify. I indicated after I marked that Supreme Court rule as an exhibit, and I said, Mr. Brinkman, do you think this is exhaustive, or do you think this is merely an illustration of the types of things? He indicated, in his opinion, it was merely illustration purposes. I would suspect for the Court's determination, because it sounds like you're going in the informed consent direction, unequivocally on the record, he was asked the question, if Dr. Thiel is going to be making this kind of decision, did you indicate to Dr. Thiel you weren't prepared? Well, no. I indicated I'd like more time. And I think drawing on the everyday experiences of life of trial lawyers, lawyers always want more time. I told my partner I wish I had another week to prepare this argument. That is a lot different than telling a client I am unprepared to try the case. I think the Code of Ethics is clear. A lawyer cannot go to trial before he is prepared. There are options. One, he can overrule the client. Then it becomes the client's option what to do. I'm not prepared to try it. If you're insisting on a trial, you're going to have to get a new lawyer. Two, the lawyer can withdraw. Indicate that if these are your demands, I cannot ethically go to trial before this case is adequately prepared. Number three, could put it on the record. Make this the judge's problem so that this is fully delineated and maybe we would get to informed consent. I would hope, even though it's a non-issue, Wisconsin wouldn't go that direction. I can't imagine another profession, a doctor. Doctor, I was diagnosed yesterday with cancer in my right leg. I can't take the emotional pressure. I know you haven't done a physical. I know you haven't done an MRI. I know you haven't done any blood work. I want you to cut my leg off tomorrow. And the doctor would say, fine, but I just want you to sign an informed consent. At some point, I think the law is clear. The lawyer dictates when this case is tried and when he's ready. But more importantly, this wasn't a complex case. It became complex in the post-conviction context. The police reports were 40 pages. The medical reports and the charts were about 100 pages. According to Mr. Brinkman's billing records of 133 hours, this is non-investigatory time, he would have an hour to read every page. I don't think it was unreasonable to expect, as counsel, that he has read all the discovery.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals here takes a different tack in terms of what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. The Court of Appeals ultimately concludes, while there were instances where trial counsel did not perform as he may have if he had more time, it was not unreasonable to take Thiel's actions into account in the way in which he handled his defense. Apparently, the Court of Appeals is giving greater weight than you would give to Thiel's intentions and requests in this case. I mean, how much weight are we supposed to give to Thiel's directions?
Some of that was credibility decisions by, I would respectfully submit, the trial court. Some of the trial counsel's defenses to certain allegations of insufficiency, I would respectfully submit, weren't plausible, weren't candid in some cases. I mean, in terms of his reading of the law, and he attempted several times to use it as a strategy. It was a strategic decision that I didn't file a 972-11 motion. How can it be? He obviously didn't read Felton. You can't hide a safe harbor for a strategic decision. He didn't know what the motion was because he hadn't read the doctor's reports. This court, I mean, put this back in context where this trial court came from. I entered the case in March of 2000. The defendant had been convicted, retained us, pre-sentencing. At sentencing, the trial court virtually adopted the state sentencing arguments that this man is a denier, this man is refusing to accept responsibility, this man is exhibiting no remorse, this man borders on being a predator, and gave him 4 years in prison as a denier. We made a strong argument for bail pending appeal. The trial court said, No. I've seen this trial. There won't be bail pending appeal. Clock goes forward 10 months. After 16 hours of Mockner testimony, after 6 weeks of research and writing an opinion, after a 24-page opinion written by the trial court, he said, in the interest of justice, the system broke and not only released Dr. Thiel from custody, but ordered a new trial on all 7 counts. That was quite a distance to travel in light of some of the testimony of counsel. In light of the factual question, just going back momentarily, not having read Metzler's report, I think the brief is pretty exhaustive, but there were factual things in preparation or in the decision whether to file a Mockner. I mean, this is pretty weighty stuff, alleging this kind of conduct by another lawyer. My partner and I went and visited with Mr. Brinkman. It became clear that he was going to testify at the Mockner hearing, should we go that way, that the reason he didn't do any independent investigation to determine what are facts and what are lies is supposedly Dr. Thiel couldn't afford it. We structured the Mockner issue on failure to investigate facts solely based on what he could have done, should have done. What was his obligation to do from his office? I'm not talking garbage collection or fancy electronic surveillance or following or witnessing. I'm talking from his office. All of the things that shocked the conscience of the court that hadn't come out at trial were all things he could have done from his office. As an example, and you need to put this in context, when Brinkman entered the case in January of 2000, the alleged victim had already come forward and said, "You're right, I planted false evidence. You're right, I obstructed justice. And you're right, I was going to commit perjury at the preliminary hearing had it been held on September 3rd. I would think a reasonably prudent lawyer would say, that's enough motivation, we should probably look further into this person. Let me show you what he would have found from his office. CCAP. I don't think that's terribly sophisticated, or an open records request. In the depositions, it appears, and this is in the regulation and licensing depositions, what would he have found from an open records request? He would have found that this victim, the same week that she went to complain to the police about Dr. James Thiel, she did the identical thing to another individual.
To a what?
She did the same thing to a Joseph Naraki.
Would you stand in front of the microphone?
I'm sorry. To a Joseph Naraki. It's an exhibit in Lieutenant Bromer's deposition.
Psychiatrist, a psychologist, or?
Just another individual. Oh. Telling the same story. Sexual relationship. I'm afraid of him. And then the coup de grace is I've told my husband about this relationship the day he came home from Bosnia, which is the identical verbatim line she used to explain the Dr. Thiel accusation. Had he gone to CCAP, what would he have found? She doesn't have a driver's license. The Court of Appeals made light of that. Is that determinative of anything? Of course not. But to put this back into context, August 19th, she goes to the police to complain that this therapist, in a predatory manner, has been exploiting her. She has been to his house, driven her car 200 times to his house. What did he miss in the discovery? One, in August, she gave the wrong address. Okay, it's just a couple numbers off. Two, she gave the wrong description of the house where it's located in the particular block. Three, 4 days later, when the police were prepared to destroy Dr. Thiel's life by the execution of search warrants and charging him with 7 counts of exploitation, they determined it probably would be prudent to have her show us the house to make sure we're executing the warrant at the right house. She got lost. Four, turns out we decided to roll the clock back and even at the most pedestrian things, see if they're true. She doesn't have a driver's license and she doesn't own a car. In and of themselves, determinative? Probably not. But in the overall picture of some inherently incredible problems for somebody who's been there 200 times, it clearly goes to credibility. And these are things that could be done from the office. Then we get to the
counsel.
Yes.
We're here as a review court, not to make an original decision, but maybe that's part of the question. You're alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, right?
We allege Chicks and ineffective, yes.
Okay. And under Strickland, there's a two-pronged test. One, did the attorney fall below the standard? And two, was falling below the standard prejudicial, right?
Correct.
And the trial court determines historical facts, right? What happened? And as I understand it, the standard of review for us is, as a legal issue, was it below the standard for representation? And two, was it prejudicial, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, and in many, if not most, ineffective assistance counsel cases, the court goes right to prejudice rather than determine whether or not the standard was met. So, because that's usually an easier, I think, test. So what is your position? Is this that, are you asking us to say that this performance was below the standard and that it was prejudicial? And if so, why was it prejudicial?
I have a couple of responses. The trial court, and I guess I put a lot of weight on substance rather than form, the concluding paragraph, page 23 of this decision, is a Hicks paragraph talking about the interest of justice and the integrity of the system. If, in fact, you find that this isn't just gratuitously thrown in as filler, that the Hicks 2, the 1986 case, was, in fact, part of the criteria, we're talking in the interest of justice. If, in fact, you conclude that even though he didn't make that magical incantation and say, in the interest of justice, I'm ordering a new trial, but find that the substance of the decision was Hicks-related, then it's deference to the trial court. Then the standard change, the rules change. If, in fact, and to some degree, there needs to be deference. And let me give you an example. The standard in newly discovered evidence. The standard in newly discovered evidence, as we all know, is that it's for the trial court, who is clearly in the best position, I'd submit, to make these kinds of decisions, to make the decision whether, in fact, it's newly discovered and whether it is of sufficient persuasive nature to undermine the confidence in the verdict. The trial court makes those decisions. We looked at, as is mentioned in our initial trial court brief, newly discovered evidence, but it doesn't qualify. Because, as I understand it, in order to be newly discovered, it can't be due to the negligence of counsel, and that's exactly what we're arguing. But the logic, the trial court's in the best position to make these kinds of decisions either in the interest of justice, or in this case, the de novo issue really is a mixed question of fact or law. What if the ultimate question of prejudice is predicated on credibility? Which it is. I mean, this whole decision is based on he said, she said. The trial court, in essence, concluded he no longer had faith in the credibility of the victim because that's all they had is a single witness.
Mr. Rosen,
yes.
2 years ago in the Trawitzky case, we set forth the standard of review consistent, I believe, with the standard of review set forth in Strickland. And that standard of review was just as the chief outlined. The standard of review, pure and simply, is we give deference to the facts found by the trial court. But when we get to the constitutional issues, the questions having to do with prejudice, the questions having to do with deficient performance, we look at that de novo. Now, you seem to be arguing for some different standard. On what basis are you making that argument?
First of all, as the court knows, in Trawitzky was decided primarily on the fact there was other overwhelming evidence against the defendant, and you de novo concluded no prejudice. That was the overwhelming other evidence in Trawitzky. That isn't true here. This is the only evidence, is the very issue, the credibility of the victim. The credibility of the alleged victim is impaired. Then this whole verdict is suspect. I'm not asking for a new standard, but I would suspect, or at least submit to the court, the standard utilized by the Court of Appeals is exactly what the trial judge warned against. You cannot take each of these deficiencies in isolation, because in isolation...
Well, let's look at this in a broad picture, then, rather than in isolation. The state takes about 11 pages in their brief to outline what defense counsel did in regard to this matter. And without getting into a lot of detail, basically they say that it was clear from a lot of the information set forth on the record by defense counsel that Pedretti had lied, that she was somewhat dishonest in some of the things that she had presented. There was ample evidence that she had lied that was on the record and developed by counsel. The indication, again, by the state going through what happened at trial was that there was aggressive cross-examination of Pedretti, the alleged victim. There was aggressive cross-examination of several other witnesses. Counsel put on a strong defense, the state claims, in regard to Thiel's behalf, and succeeded in keeping out a lot of evidence that could have been damaging to Thiel. Now, if we're to look at this not in isolation, but in a broad sense, do we not have to look at the whole trial to determine whether or not there was prejudice here?
No. And I really would
say that. You're not suggesting we now look at it in isolation, because you just told me we shouldn't do that.
The context of the state's brief here is a sufficiency of the evidence argument. If, in fact, it is a sufficiency of the evidence argument, I would probably be the first to admit that there was enough evidence for them to convict Dr. Thiel. But in the context of in the interest of justice or deficient performance, ineffective assistance, we're not talking about what was submitted to the jury. We're talking about what was not submitted. And you can't do that in a sufficiency of the evidence context. And the state argues, as an example of justice, this was cumulative. And I think the cases, Washington, the Seventh Circuit case, is not cumulative, because the more lies you show against a witness, the witness comes out not as a person who told a lie, but as a liar. If the state had stipulated that this woman is a liar, then this is, of course, is all cumulative. That was the ultimate issue. She was allowed to portray herself as having told a singular lie that Dr. Thiel made her do. They gave her 2 days to come up with that. They told her there's problems with the evidence. She gets 2 days to get a lawyer and come up with the story that was never explored at trial, to come up with the story that Dr. Thiel made me do it. Is that a search for the truth? What you do is you call the victim in. You don't tell her we're getting ready for trial. We'd like to talk to you. You come in and you confront her with it. You don't give somebody 2 days to come up with an explanation of how the defendant made her do it.
Let me ask you something else, following up on what Justice Wilcox asked earlier. Is it not correct that your client wanted to proceed, didn't want any delays, because he was concerned about other acts evidence, other people coming forward with information that would be detrimental to him concerning similar types of acts? Is that disputed?
That is the unrebutted status of the record. I don't know if that means
isn't that significant as we look at all of this, especially when you're now arguing in terms of the interests of justice?
Do I think it's significant that a lawyer went to trial unprepared, never told his client was unprepared, and he had 60 days? I mean, at least federally it's presumptive 60 days is adequate time to get ready if someone's choosing to do so. 133 hours, three quarters of 1 hour devoted to research. And you wonder why he misinterpreted 97211, or he didn't understand that Brian Eckern wasn't a prior consistent statement at all, that she confided in somebody after the plan had been put in action. The action started 16 months earlier when she supposedly had this semen sample. The plan is now started, when it's to be implemented. It's in that window that she allegedly confides to this assistant district attorney. That's not a prior consistent statement. before there's a motive to fabricate. To fabricate, the motive already exists. She started the plan. The lawyer didn't even see that. And I would respectfully submit the trial court missed it. They were focusing on July 26th, July 30th. In that 16-month window, the plan was in operation. It is in that window she is creating evidence to later be retrieved at trial. The jury was entitled to know that, and I would respectfully submit that in that case, I think Eckerton's testimony was totally excludable. It doesn't have that innocent aspect where there's no motive to fabricate. She's already collected the semen. She tells that to the police. She tells it to Metzler in her confidential therapeutic notes. And it's in this interim she's talking to people. Is that the kind of innocence that 90801 refers to? I don't think so. So then you truly get a naked, alleged victim with no alleged corroboration and nothing but lies based upon lies, and had a reasonably prudent lawyer looked and not assumed, I think they would have been exposed.
Well,
Mr. Rosen, you indicated that I thought I heard you say that you had not been involved in a Mockner hearing before, or at least there was some degree of rarity because of the importance of this. Well, from our vantage point, we see Mockner hearings all the time. Ineffective assistance of counsel, it's like you throw it into every petition for review. What is the rule, if you were to win, what is the rule that you would want to come out of this case that wouldn't just do incredible damage to the criminal law?
I would hope the rule is lawyers read Supreme Court Rule 21.2. Those are the decisions that a client controls. The rest is the lawyer's. A lawyer cannot, under any circumstances that I can envision, ever go to trial unprepared. Whether it was an innocent mistake, a benign mistake, I don't know. He was unprepared. It's either that or he was deluding himself that since this woman already lied, this is going to be a walk in the park. We don't need to do much. And he got the pants tried off of him, candidly. But what's so ironic or unusual about this is we're each arguing different positions. Generally, the state wins the Mockner hearings. We're arguing de novo. Here we won. They're arguing de novo. So it's unusual in terms of the dynamics because we're each taking positions that typically we don't take. Thank you.
Counsel, if I may, you argue that the Court of Appeals here is misapplying the long-accepted standard in Strickland. And I think you point to their first paragraph and the language in their last paragraph. But isn't their application and their discussion, as the opinion unfolds, really following the Strickland standard?
It is taking the prejudice aspect in isolation. Yes, they're following Strickland, but I think Strickland requires that in order to evaluate prejudice, assuming that's de novo, and I guess that to some degree I'm not conceding because if it's Hicks, it's not de novo. It's deference. And if it's credibility driven, it's a mixed question of fact and law. That's not de novo either. But exactly what Judge Pasal predicted that he hoped would not happen is that each of these ostensibly innocuous things would not be taken together in order to evaluate prejudice. This was dissected one by one without ever getting to the issues that really couldn't be defended, such as the lawyer not reading the discovery before trial, such as the lawyer interpreting 97211 to mean what he claims it meant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Attorney Daniel J. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. After listening to Mr. Rosen's argument, I guess I can understand why the good trial judge was misled into issuing a wrong decision. It's pretty compelling, but when you look more closely at the law, as well as the trial transcript and the transcript of the post-conviction hearing, you must conclude under Strickland v. Washington that counsel, and you must do independently conclude, as did the Court of Appeals, that counsel's performance was neither deficient nor prejudicial. Now, Mr. Rosen is arguing for some sort of a deferential standard of review here, but doesn't really articulate what that is. The fact is, this Court has no authority under the federal Constitution to change Strickland v. Washington. And Strickland v. Washington is unequivocal in that the issues of deficient performance and prejudice are to be reviewed de novo. And this Court in State v. Pitch, 124 was second at 634, said, we do not give deference to the trial court's decision on the issues of deficient performance and prejudice.
But deference is given at, for issues of fact.
Findings of fact and credibility determinations.
Well, wasn't I read the trial court thing. It seems to me that credibility just runs rampant through his decision.
There are a lot of conclusions about credibility, but they're not attached to any specific findings. Obviously, credibility was the critical issue at trial, and but I'm not sure what he found, what he believed or disbelieved at the post-conviction hearing. He made a number of findings of fact, that supposedly the attorney didn't read Dr. Metzler's report, that the attorney didn't pull up the motor vehicle record of the victim. I don't know anything about this Mr. Nowritzki that counsel talked about. That's not mentioned anywhere in his brief, and I don't recall it coming up at the post-conviction hearing, so I don't know what that details. But the fact that when a trial judge makes findings of fact, unless they're clearly erroneous, this Court gives deference to them. But when the trial judge says, counsel didn't do this and counsel should have done it, well, that second step is something subject to independent review, because
counsel,
that's
what if, at least I find, if the words aren't in the trial judge's decision, it seems that they are there impliedly, implicitly. And those words are, I find that the issues that were not raised by trial counsel, which have been raised and resolved in the Mockner hearing, lead me to believe that the credibility of Ms. Pedretti, if that's her name, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, is highly questionable. That's what I think he's, that's what I think is the final analysis of the trial judges. Is that a finding of fact or a finding of law?
Well, that's the finding of fact that the State never disputed.
Well, then how can you win if the trial
Because her credibility difference? Was subject to challenge at trial. The
but
State never disputed at
we're
trial.
We're talking over each other, Mr. O'Brien, please. I didn't understand you from the first time you started to respond to me, because we were talking over each other. Could you start over again, please?
Well, the State never disputed at trial that she lied about important matters, and she lied to a number of different people. That was never in dispute. At best, this stuff is cumulative on the issue of her general credibility, that her character for truthfulness, as opposed to specific facts relevant to this case. Nothing in this business of, you know, what they were able to come up with in a post-conviction deposition taken 10 months after the trial has anything to do with the undisputed fact that she manufactured false evidence, that she lied to several people about this evidence, that she was caught in the lie by the police in December of 1999, that she had a romantic relationship with Mr. Eckern, nor does it do anything to undermine the extremely strong corroborating other acts evidence by two independent women, including Thiel's ex-wife, nor the corroborating evidence from those women and Lieutenant Bromer corroborating her description of his home, of his genitalia, of his habits, what he watches on television when he's at home. None of that is affected one whit by any of this that came out at this lengthy post-conviction hearing.
Wouldn't you, would maybe you disagree, but my feeling from reading the trial court decision is that the trial court judge was in essence saying, boy, a lot of stuff didn't come out at trial that should have, and in my mind, the trial court's mind, it raises very serious questions about her credibility that go beyond the evidence that was shown to this jury. And he's saying that I think her credibility was would have been very, very damaged.
And
in fact, he said that explicitly.
Well, and all I can tell you, and you are to review, again, deficient performance and prejudice de novo, so it really is your job to review the trial transcript.
I am asking you about the fact. It seems to me that it is a finding of fact that her credibility was seriously, much more seriously impaired as the result of the Mockner hearing than it was at trial. That is a finding of fact, is it not? I don't mean to cross-examine.
I hate to concede, but it may very well be. But then if it is, it is clearly erroneous when one reviews this trial. You know, this morning I was rereading the extensive cross-examination of Joanne, and counsel, Attorney Brinkman went into great length on all of the points relative to her credibility, establishing one thing after another for the jury about her lies or her inconsistencies, her confusion. And so if the judge honestly found that this was a – that these peccadilloes, I will say, that Attorney Brinkman engaged in that were discovered well after the trial greatly, severely undermined her credibility beyond what was established at trial, then that's clearly erroneous. But, you know, there's another point here, too. As a real threshold matter here, one thing that's a gaping hole in Judge Pacelli's decision is the fact Brinkman was not the only defense attorney involved in this case. There were two others. There was an attorney LeGrand who represented him from September to January, and there was an attorney Margarita Van Nuland who worked with Brinkman in preparation of this case. Were they ineffective? We don't know. They weren't called by him to testify at the post-conviction hearing. Van Nuland, however, was aggressively involved in the pretrial motion hearings and did a lot of work on this case as well. If Brinkman did something wrong, what about these other two people who were also involved? And the fact, and I guess if you say something over and over and over again, then it becomes true. And counsel keeps saying that Attorney Brinkman was unprepared. That's not true. Attorney Brinkman testified unequivocally that he was prepared for this trial. And yes, he was on the case 60 days, but he took over a case that another attorney had for several months. I presume that Attorney LeGrand gave him his files and documents, police reports, whatnot. And I assume Attorney Van Nuland helped him a great deal during the 60-day period. And, you know, so right there, there's a severe problem with Judge Pacelli's decision, simply ignoring the fact that there were two other attorneys involved in this defense. And my experience with trial defense was in law school when I was an intern with the Public Defender's Office, and that's it. But it just seems to me if I were a defense attorney and I felt reasonably prepared for trial, and I would agree that you would always want more time to prepare. I wish I had another week to prepare for this argument as well because there are so many facts here. But if my client came up to me and said, oppose the state's motion for an adjournment because I want this case to go to trial right now, there's a Department of Regulations and Licensing investigation going on right now, and they might come up with more other witnesses than the one that's already listed, I would give that pretty serious weight in my decision as to how I'm going to proceed to trial. I would not just blow it off and say, that's not your decision.
Counsel, I want to stay with the standard of review. If the essence of the trial court's decision is it was an unfair trial, in the interest of justice, we're going to set aside the conviction. What's the standard of review for that?
Well, I would disagree that that was the essence of the trial judge's decision. And that if it was, why go to the great extent of having a 3-day Mockner hearing or whatever it was? But assuming there was, I think it's pretty clear under 75106 the standard is de novo, and I think that's pretty clear under Hicks. This court independently determines whether the real controversy was fully and fairly tried. And that's because this 75106 gives this court separate and distinct authority without regard to what the trial judge did or did not do regarding the new trial interests of justice. But to be honest with you, I'm not fully prepared to make that argument because that issue was never briefed. The Hicks issue was never briefed in the Court of Appeals. It was not raised in the petition for review. It was not even raised in Mr. Thiel's opening brief in this court. It was thrown in the reply brief.
Well, counsel, as I recall the Court of Appeals opinion in dissent, that's what the focus of the Court of Appeals dissenting opinion was. It ends with, was this a fair trial? When a judge answers that question, no, and there are facts and evidence to support the answer, appellate court should only in a rare case reverse that answer, and this is not one of those cases. I mean, it seems to me that the Court of Appeals dissent concludes with the point that it was the focus of the circuit court whether or not this case was fairly tried. The last paragraph of the court's opinion, the circuit court's opinion, is the ultimate guarantor of a just result is a fair trial. A fair trial requires the effective assistance of counsel. This standard was not met, citing Hicks. Seems to me that an argument can be made that this issue has been presented to the court.
Well, I don't think it was. I mean, if you look at the petition for review and Mr. Thiel's opening brief, there's no separate argument of a neutral interest of justice, and there are entirely separate issues there. Was the real controversy fully tried as opposed to was counsel's performance deficient and prejudicial? Now, ultimately, Strickland is a due process analysis. Did the defendant receive a fair trial with a reliable result? That's ultimately the answer. You know, the focus of an independent inquiry is on the fairness of the proceeding. No question. But that doesn't mean it's the same as a neutral interest of justice analysis where the defendant now has the burden of proving that the real controversy was not fully and fairly tried. And I would suggest that Judge Bissell might very well have been uncomfortable with going that far because when one reads the entire trial transcript, it is hard to say that the real controversy with regard to what happened about the victim's lies, the manufacturing of false evidence, whatnot, was not fully tried. You can debate whether counsel should have done things differently, and that's a separate ineffective assistance issue. But it's very hard to say after one reads that transcript from cover to cover, including the pretrial motion hearings, that the real controversy, the credibility of Joanne vis-a-vis Mr. Thiel and the credibility of Joanne as corroborated by the other acts evidence and by the independent testimony regarding his behavior, his genitalia, whatnot, that was not fully tried. I just think that's a real reach to go that far, but one could debate whether counsel's performance was deficient and if so, whether it was prejudicial, but that's a burden that Mr. Thiel has to carry, and we submit that he didn't do it. The Court of Appeals agreed with that.
Mr. O'Brien, I'm going to stay with the standard for review, and I want to know if this is the State's position. The defendant must show that there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. A reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. Confidence in the outcome is not based on the result of the trial. Wisconsin has rejected any outcome determinative standard. A confidence in the outcome is undermined if the proceedings themselves are not deemed to be reliable, the focus is on the reliability of the process, which provides the assurance that the result of the proceeding is reliable. The question then is whether or not the particular proceedings were unreliable because of a breakdown in the adversarial process that our system counts on to produce just results.
There's a lot there,
and it's all quotations from either Strickland or Pitch.
Right, and I hesitate only because your counsel relies heavily on the Seventh Circuit decision in Washington v. Smith, where they talk about the distinction between the outcome determinative test, reasonable probability of a different outcome, and the reliability of the proceedings. And, you know, it's a difficult nut to crack. I think at bottom, the reasonable probability of a different outcome is present any time you analyze this. And that generally generally guides the court in determining whether whether the result is unreliable. If there is a reasonable probability of a different outcome, then a fortiori, the result is unreliable. Now,
but it can undermine confidence, and you can say another jury still might reach the same result if the error was corrected. I mean, when you
go
back to trial and you put in all of the matters that Thiel's defense counsel wants, state might also put in more issues or be able to refute what Thiel puts in. The result might be the same, but there still might be a question of the reliability of this particular proceeding.
There could be. Okay. Obviously, I don't believe that's a problem here because.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you don't grant outright dismissal. You remand for a new trial because the defense gets to put in the evidence they wanted to put in, and the state then can rebut it or can put in additional evidence that it might have accumulated since. Sure.
So do you stand by the Strickland test as the test for prejudice?
Yes. I think I do. I think this Court has consistently followed the Strickland test throughout, especially in cases such as Pitch and more recently Trowitzki. And I think it's clear that Strickland does not give deference on the issues of deficient performance only and prejudice only on the questions of the not clearly erroneous facts as found.
We've had cases that say, yes, this is a question of law. Yes, we review it de novo. But in reviewing it de novo, we recognize that in this particular area, which is so fact-law related, we give a little edge to the trial court because the trial court saw the witnesses and heard them and can put it together more easily and perhaps more correctly than this court can. You're familiar with that line of cases.
Right, right.
Why doesn't this case fit within it?
Because that doesn't mean that you defer to the trial judge's legal conclusions in a situation.
Sure.
This is not like an abuse of discretion review where you're reviewing a sentence that everyone agrees was within statutory lengths but maybe was too long or something. Did the judge properly exercise discretion? The trial judge is, and this recent Supreme Court case cited by counsel, again, only reaffirms that the trial judge is in the best situation to develop the facts, what happened. Then the judge is allowed to make legal conclusions therefrom, and if no one appeals, those conclusions stand. If a party does appeal, then this court or the court of appeals below it independently determines, based on those facts, whether or not there was sufficient performance and prejudice. And I'll give an example. All this business about not reading discovery, what this really boils down to is counsel didn't read Dr. Metzler's report before trial. Dr. Metzler was a rebuttal witness called by the state. And the only point to be established by that had counsel read Dr. Metzler's report, so let's assume that's a correct finding of fact, not clearly erroneous. Counsel didn't read Dr. Metzler's report before trial. So the question is, so what? The so what is what this court independently determines. Judge Pascal said, so what? That's deficient, that's prejudicially deficient performance. Why? Because had he read the report, he would have seen that Joanne also lied to him about the semen sample after she reported it to police. And it's our position, and the Court of Appeals agreed, that the so what just doesn't, that's not prejudice under the Strickland standard, because all it proves is that she was consistent all throughout, that she said the same lie to him as she had to everyone else, and that was all established at trial. And so it really doesn't add much, if anything. And it supports the defense theory that she did it in anticipation of litigation. She had already reported to the police. She knew Metzler's reports were probably going to be turned over to the state at some point, to law enforcement. And so I damn well better be consistent in my lie. So the jury knew all that already. So what does that add up to? It adds up to nothing. And so that's where you step in. And that's where the appellate court determines whether this really made a difference. It's real difficult in reviewing this decision. I don't think there's any standard that says because a trial judge is willing to put his neck on the line, therefore this court must defer. And that really seems to be what counsel is in essence arguing. I think it's in giving deference to the trial judge, when you're dealing with constitutional standards, you run a real danger of establishing a constitutional standard that A is either too high or B in some cases could be too low. And so this Court has to independently review that ultimate decision on the constitutional question. And there are times when a judge is making a legal determination like that, where even though he's there, he or she is there, listening to these witnesses, seeing their demeanor, sometimes the judge can't see the forest for the trees. Sometimes there's so much information. Sometimes emotions get involved. Personalities get involved. And that's why you want a transcript to be able to review on appeal. You want findings of fact.
Mr. O'Brien, how closely akin is our harmless error rule to the prejudicial prong of the Strickland test?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question. I would say I think if you go back and read Dias, I think it's quite close. The difference, obviously, is in the burden of proof. You know, obviously, under Strickland, the defense has the burden of proof. Under Dias and its progeny, the state has the burden. But I know that in the varying opinions in Dias, there's all kinds of discussion about how close is the reasonable possibility of a different outcome to the Strickland reasonable probability standard. I mean, I think just is a layman would look at, well, reasonable probability has got to be a little tougher burden than reasonable possibility. But I think this Court's decision seemed to indicate that those are quite close.
Well, if you go back to Fahey, that's what the U.S. Supreme Court says, too, in Chapman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, and then we have the varying harmless error standards in themselves, and how different is the Chapman standard from the Dias standard and all of that. And I don't want to get too much into that because I know there are other cases dealing with those issues, and I'm not prepared to argue that, but I think those standards are pretty close.
And one other question, going back to where I was earlier with you, I found the language in the trial court. He concludes at the top of page 5, or appendix 21, while other explanations might be offered for these facts, and he's talking about the facts that came out at the Mockner hearing as opposed to the facts that the jury didn't hear, the sum total effect of this, had it been heard by the jury, was to substantially diminish the complainant's believability. End of quote. Is that a finding of fact?
It's difficult because it's one step. It's one thing if he had said, I find Attorney Brinkman's testimony at the post-conviction hearing to be incredible. That would be a finding of fact, but he's taking it one step removed. He's saying that in my review of the trial here at the post-conviction hearing, her testimony would have been further diminished, or would have been greatly diminished. I guess it is a finding of fact once removed, and again, I would say that's clearly erroneous. I think and this gets to another point I want to make, and I think it's a problem that's underlying the trial judge's decision, and it's a difficult one to grasp, but I think if you bear with me, counsel argues throughout that it basically doesn't matter whether when you have a credibility case such as this one, it doesn't matter in an analyzing deficient performance and prejudice whether the additional credibility evidence is cumulative. And they rely on the Washington v. Smith case out of the Seventh Circuit. And I think that's oversimplification. If the additional evidence that the attorney failed to put on goes directly to issues of guilt or innocence, such as the defendant's presence at the scene, the defendant's physical evidence being left at the scene, or corroboration of other acts, evidence, that sort of thing, where a credibility evidence goes directly to issues in dispute, obviously, in the Washington v. Smith case, for example, the defense attorney failed to put on two unimpeachable alibi witnesses and a witness who would testify the defendant didn't own the gun. And the state argued that was cumulative evidence, and the Seventh Circuit said, no, that's not cumulative because those issues were all still in dispute and they went directly to guilt or innocence. Even though there was another alibi witness, and even though there were other witnesses who said it might have been the defendant's gun, that's not cumulative because that's strong evidence on directly disputed points relating to guilt or innocence. That is to be contrasted with the situation presented in the Trowitzki decision where the evidence goes just to general credibility, that this, the defense attorney failed to put on evidence that the witness had prior convictions. That doesn't go directly to the guilt or innocence. It doesn't relate directly to the issues of was the defendant at the scene, was his physical evidence there, was there corroboration. This is just general credibility of that particular witness. And that, I would suggest, if that, that is of far less significance, even in a credibility case, and that that type of evidence, if it's already been established in other manners, like, for instance, even if you didn't prove that he had two prior convictions, the witness admitted that he had spent the last 20 years in prison, then that's cumulative. And it just isn't that much weight. And if you look at the trial judge's decision here, all of this is the sort of cumulative, tangential, general credibility. This proves that she's even more of a liar than the jury already knew she was at trial. It doesn't go directly to whether she manufactured the false semen evidence, whether she told police a lie, whether she lied to Ekron, whether she had a romantic relationship with Ekron. These are all points that were established. It doesn't go to undermine the corroborative other acts evidence. It doesn't go to undermine the corroboration by the defendant's ex-wife about the layout of his home, his physical appearance, and all of that thing, all of that. And so we're talking about not specific credibility issues in dispute, but just general credibility. We have more proof that she's a liar than we already put on. You know, I would submit you could do that in every single case. You could sit down, as they did here 10 months after the fact, and go and question witnesses and catch them in inconsistencies, catch them in lies, catch them in confusion, and then go back into a trial court and say, this attorney was ineffective because if he had spent 10 more minutes with this witness, he might have gotten an inconsistency. You know, I love the argument that even though Brinkman, the trial judge conceded that Brinkman interviewed Brian Ekron, he didn't interview him enough because Ekron might have admitted the romantic nature of the relationship. Well, the fact is, the police and the district attorney interviewed Eckerd, as did defense counsel, and he didn't tell anyone that they had a romantic relationship. So I don't see how you can reach the conclusion that the attorney's performance was prejudicially deficient because he didn't badger this guy long enough to get him to finally admit that there was a romantic relationship for 6 weeks or something
like that. Well, so you put together the prejudicially deficient, and I want to separate them. The Court of Appeals opinion focused on whether or not this was deficient performance. If the circuit court's findings or conclusions as to deficient performance are correct, are you advancing that even if there is deficient performance, it wasn't prejudicial in this case?
Well, I, in every respect, I mean, I so strongly dispute a lot of those findings of, or conclusions of deficient performance. But I would say, as a general response to your question, yes, it was non-prejudicial for the very reason I just pointed out. This all goes to just general credibility of the victim. It doesn't prove or disprove the salient facts that were all brought out in great detail before the jury at trial. And I, again, would strongly urge this Court, even though it's a very painstaking thing to do, to review that trial transcript. Because I, to be honest with you, I think after you do so, you're going to read Judge Bissell's decision and you're going to say, as I do after watching a football or basketball game, what game was he watching?
Counsel, I'm glad that you said that. I've been somewhat hesitant to ask this question. I have not read the trial transcript. And in your, but in your brief, you say, Joanne described in great detail unique aspects of Thiel's anatomy, including his genitalia, and that this was corroborated, much of which was corroborated by an officer who had seen him without clothing. That could be pretty powerful evidence. Can you describe it somewhat sensitively, a little bit more than what you put in your paragraph?
It dealt with the size of the scrotum relative to the size of the penis. And there was also a discussion of his pale-colored skin and hair color and whatnot. And that's another thing, that defense counsel successfully kept away photographs of him that were taken by the officer from the jury. That over defense counsel's objection, the state was allowed to photograph him in the nude to corroborate not only the victim's but the ex-wife's testimony regarding his genitalia. And the it was put in instead by stipulation, that the party stipulated that Detective Brohmer saw him naked, and it corroborates the account of his genitalia by both the victim and Suzanne. And so I think if you read that, you will see, if you read victim's testimony, Suzanne, the ex-wife's testimony, and then the stipulation, I think you will see that there were, it was unique. I mean, it wasn't one in a trillion, but it was a quite unique physical description. And I see my red light is on, so if there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Rosen, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
The genitalia. I think you're allowed to draw on the everyday experiences of life. This was a pretty generic description of a 50-year-old, 55-year-old male that could have probably met or fit the criteria of half the guys I see at the locker room when we work out.
Well,
there was not. There were no scars.
Whose experience in life you're talking about, I suppose.
There were no scars. In fact, some of her identification was inaccurate. It was a pretty generic description, and there was nothing unique other than what the prosecutor argued based on her experience in closing argument. But going back for a moment to what's the big deal about Dr. Metzler and not having read certain records. When Attorney Brinkman was asked about his theory of the defense, I mean, let's look at the big picture. What's your defense? The defendant did not do it. I said, okay, that's a good start. What is your theory of the defense to explain either the genitalia, Suzanne Pride, Rebecca? What is your, the defendant is not guilty. I said, well, could you be a little more specific as to what your theory is other than blindly going into he is not guilty? And eventually we sifted and winnowed it, and what it started coming back to was Metzler and the 970-11. His theory of the prosecution in this case, based on his erroneous, I would humbly suggest ridiculous, interpretation of 970-11, he interpreted and testified to, he thought if he didn't bring up anything to she told psychiatrists, including Thiel, the defendant wouldn't have been allowed to rebut anything she said because there was no motion, that the state couldn't do it. And it was on that basis that he went to trial under the strategy that he very tactfully kept out all of this evidence because he didn't make a 970-11 motion. That is flawed from its inception. Metzler's records are compelling. And the reason the judge relied on Dr. Metzler, Dr. Thiel was the treating psychiatrist until August of 1999. When she chose to go to the police and bring these charges against Dr. Thiel, she got a new therapist for help. That was Dr. Metzler's and shortcut. She testified that a reason for telling all of these lies to people, to the state, to the prosecutor, was to try to bluff Dr. Thiel into admitting his guilt. Obviously, he didn't take the bluff. I mean, you would think if somebody had engaged in this activity, it is theoretically possible she could have this sample, but there was no such thing. The court took great note of the fact there's no motive to lie when you've left this evil therapist and now you're in the hands of somebody who's trying to help you. That you go to this person and not only tell the same lies, but incredible other ones, as an example. In Dr. Metzler's notes, she confides to Dr. Metzler, and put this in context, at trial she told how she was so afraid of Dr. Thiel. It was a condition of Dr. Thiel's bail that there not be any contact. She tells Dr. Metzler, well, I did call Dr. Thiel after I went to the police and he was charged criminally. I went to a phone booth. Now, this is somebody smart enough to know that somebody might get her phone records. Goes to a phone booth and had a secret meeting with Dr. Thiel. That never came out of evidence. That's potentially incredible testimony. She lies to the therapist about being unemployed or employed, but it's one lie with no possible motive to fabricate. And that's why Metzler was critical. As Professor Our expert testified at the Mockner hearing, this was a golden opportunity. You have their expert on cross. You have the notes, and you can lead this witness through his notes, lie after lie, where there was no reason to lie, other than two explanations. She doesn't know the difference between truth and falsehood, or she's a very smart liar.
Counsel, rather than ask you to detail, as I was about to, in bullet form, all of the evidence that came out at Mockner that you believe was most important that wasn't brought out at trial, the trial court opinion has a lot of those. What, if anything, did the trial court opinion miss that you want to bring to our attention? Or can we rely on the trial court opinion?
I think you can rely. I mean, I think...
For everything. There's nothing that...
When you're at... I see my light is on, if I can respond.
You may respond, counsel.
When trial courts are present at a proceeding, it's much... When litigators are present in court, it's different than it appears in the naked page. I mean, there are things that happen. I read a transcript and say, that wasn't the hearing I was at. That isn't how I remember it. The dynamics, the body language. If I were to humbly suggest the one thing that shocked the trial court was the phone records.
The what?
The phone records.
The 44 phone calls?
This was her corroboration, her prior consistent statement. I confided in, they kept dressing him up as an officer of the court, somebody who would never tell a falsehood, that she had been confiding in him for quite some time. And they both, by coincidence, describe one. By omission, they never tell that they were lovers. I find that quite a coincidence. And they each describe their contact as sporadic.
Are you referring to the telephone calls that she made to Thiel?
No.
Or the telephone calls she made to Eckhart?
Right. And they were allowed to portray the contact sporadic where these two witnesses didn't get their stories together. And we were talking about what a lawyer can do from his office. We faxed a subpoena to the telephone company. Unfortunately, they're frighteningly easy to get. You subpoena the record custodian, tell him to appear on the day of trial, but if he is kind enough and wants to submit him to us within 10 working days, you're relieved of having to appear, and miraculously, these phone records always appear at our office. These records were chilling, not because of the 41 calls, and this is between two witnesses that were allowed to portray themselves as distant officers of the court that bordered on co-conspirators. There were 41 phone calls. 40 phone calls. You then take an overlay, as we argued to Judge Pasal, and you take a transparency of acts that are occurring within the prosecution of Dr. Thiel and see if there is any correlation between what's happening in the Thiel prosecution and the contacts, substantial contacts, between these witnesses. July 30th, the blow-up with Dr. Thiel. Who does she call? Eckhart. August 16th, she goes to pick up the records so she can review them before she goes to the police. Who does she talk to? Eckhart. August 19th, she goes to the police and is now talked within an hour of arriving at home. Who does she talk to? Eckhart. The morning of the preliminary hearing, she looks to Eckhart for guidance. I guess she wants a litmus test. What kind of questions is somebody going to ask on cross-examination? December 15th, the fraud is discovered. Who does she call? Eckhart. You don't need to hear the contents of the conversations. It's obvious. I would hope that now this case is going to be a published decision, that we guide the conduct of current lawyers, future lawyers, in a way that recognizes the responsibility. Somebody's life and liberty, you at least have to read the discovery. You have to check out and see facts. You have to do something other than cash the check.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen.
Thank you,
Mr. O'Brien. And if the court would stay seated, please, I'd appreciate it. Everyone else, I think, may be excused. The camera is here, just so I can tell you, for a video that is being taped of the court for purposes of the court's 150th anniversary as a separate institution, and a video will be made of it so that it can be displayed in the courtroom. Now, do you want everybody to stay seated if we can keep them here for a few moments without being accused? Pardon me? Right. Now, we don't want any false imprisonment concepts here. So, if count, you want, which count? Do you want one counsel at the podium? Okay. Mr. Rosen, if you would stand at the podium for 10 seconds.
This is free pub. Mr. Rosen, this only is your, free publicity.
Only your,
where's my card?
From your back. Only your back will show.
Please,
and
please take the name tag off your back.
Only my bald spot?
Only your best parts. Done. You didn't count on that for today. We're going to be signaled. Okay, Mr. Rosen, thank you. Mr. O'Brien. You want us to speak with him? Is that the point? Are you on? I hope you're not on audio on all of this. All right, that's good. Mr. O'Brien, you've appeared before this court many times. How many years have you been an attorney with the Assistant Attorney General?
Too many.
Too many.
Good for you. Good answer. It's been a long time. I think you've been...
Got everything all set? How many years?
22, actually.
How much?
What year did you start?
81.
81. Yeah. Well, that's great. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. It's good having both of you. That closes the hearing in 01-1589 CR, State v. Thiel.